This is tape two, side one of Bruno Augustine interview.
Now, a lot of the reports on purely scientific issues, as I mentioned, didn't go through that process. The satellite reports were simply written as reports. I think there was very little briefing done on the early satellite reports. That was simply work that was accomplished within RAND and then documented. And then the documents were distributed. Some of the later satellite reports, talking about the project feedback reports in 54, for example, they were extensively briefed as well as documented. So you had this mixture, but the work that was intended to influence policy got a very arduous screening, and the work that was intended to convey new scientific or scientific information of some sort, that got much less of a screening process, and you simply got a review by your peers. Every report that is ever written in RAND is reviewed internally by RAND, and in many cases also by people outside RAND before it gets published. That's always been the case, and it still is the case.
Who coordinates and enforces that procedure? Is it a front office function? Is it the publications department?
It's usually a project whose project leader is in a given department, or most of the work is done within a given department. The department head will designate reviewers who are not connected with the project, but who he feels have a competence and feels that are important for this document. And depending on the level of the report, today the RAND-R, which is the sort of the RAND report, which gets very wide circulation, that has to have two or three senior reviewers. And they have the power to stop a report from being issued, and that power is, on occasion, it's exercised. In most cases, the report, if they disagree strongly with it, has to be rewritten at least before it gets published. So there is a mechanism for essentially saying that this report is suitable for publication. It's an accurate representation of sound work, and it reflects the way in which RAND wants to influence people. There are lesser reports which go to specific audiences which are designated, and there you may need only one reviewer. You can write a paper inside RAND, either as a RAND paper or as a paper for external publication in a professional journal. You don't need a reviewer for that. You expect the peer review process in the professional journal to accomplish what you want accomplished.
Is that the P series? Or?
Well, that's the old P series is you had the opportunity to write papers at RAND that were unclassified, that were your own personal product, and that you didn't, they were not addressed to a specific client. They were done just for the general public. And you could write those, that paper that you have, for example, is a case in point, all that happened to be published later. In many cases, the RAND P was the forerunner to a journal publication also. But you don't have to write a RAND P to make a journal publication come out. You can just contribute an article directly to a journal. And that is reviewed by the normal journal review processes rather than internally at RAND, by and large.
You've compared, switching topics a little bit, you've compared the RAND situation with the university experience that you had. Could you briefly compare RAND with your aerophysics lab experience? There seems like there's some similarities.
I think there's a much greater similarity there. I think that the major difference was that we didn't have soft scientists in the aerophysics laboratory. We had specific technical projects that we wanted to accomplish, and you know we were not in a position to either want to or influence U.S. policy or its policy choices. We essentially said we had a specific objective, which is to create a better weapon system. Let's just take that case in point. So we didn't feel that we needed soft scientists to do that, and so aerophysics, by and large, did not have soft scientists. It had a few mathematicians and statisticians who were, you know, essentially very deeply involved in a lot of the projects that went on. But other than that, within the aerophysics laboratory, we had a very great range of hard disciplines, and they were always in contact with one another. At one time, the aerophysics laboratory was essentially one floor of a very large building, and there were no offices in there. There were just innumerable desks and so on. And so you could walk around and talk to anybody, and they could come and visit you. And that was the informal communication channel in aerophysics. So we had a very great range of technical and scientific and engineering disciplines in the same building talking among one another. And in that sense, there was a close analogy to RAND. The only thing that was different is the leavening produced by the soft scientists, which is the thing that was unique to RAND, at least in those days.
You mentioned briefly as kind of a case in point the development of weapon systems. To what extent at that point were you thinking about development of weapon systems as systems?
That's a kind of a hard question to answer. You're talking about the aerophysics lab now.
Right. Well, what I'm thinking of is that one of the questions we're interested in is that RAND seems to have taken, compared to industry proposals for various things like ICBMs and some anti-ballistic missile studies, a much broader systems approach in developing these proposals in industry.
Well,
to originate at North America in your case.
There are lots of ways to answer that, but one of the answers which emphasizes the difference, and it may emphasize it a little more than I intend to, is in industry normally, and in aerophysics, the aerophysics laboratory normally, what came into the building was essentially a set of requirements that said, you know, I, the Air Force, want to achieve this kind of a capability. Now you go about telling me how to do this and go ahead and do it. Now at RAND, you start several steps further beyond that. At RAND, what comes into the building, or at least came into the building in a comparable time period, is not a set of requirements. It's a set of objectives, and you know the objective might be that I want to maintain the strategic balance of the U.S. compared with foreign competitors. So you would begin to worry about the political context in which, how much latitude you would be provided politically to do this. B, you would essentially be in a position or have to formulate your own set of requirements. And then you would go through a comparable process that the industry went. So the thing that happened at RAND is that the process of thinking about weapon systems started much further back in the decision chain than it did in industry. At aerophysics, as I said, we essentially responded to requirements that Washington said they felt they needed. Now, as it turned out, in practical life, the world really never operates quite that way, because in the aerophysics laboratory, you know, we began saying that in the late 40s, you know, let's not think about you're wanting to build a glide rocket to go 500 miles because, you know, who needs 500 miles? Let's think about intercontinental ones. Well, you can't do that with a glide rocket. You couldn't do that in the day. So we said, why don't you think about a ramjet missile instead of a glide rocket? You know, so we in a sense, were beginning to influence the set of requirements that came into the building that we responded to. And that that continued later on when you know the major outgrowths of the aerophysics laboratories were, for example, the rocket propulsion work that went off to Santa Susana, and then there was a lot of nuclear-related work that went off that got started in the late 40s. So in a sense, we were not in the aerophysics days realistically simply responding to requirements. We were beginning to suggest that there might be better or more effective means for doing some of the things that the Air Force in particular felt they wanted to do. But that was kind of the exception still in aerophysics, whereas at RAND it was not the exception. It was the rule essentially that we had enough latitude so that we were not simply given requirements to try to implement, because, you know, it wasn't clear that RAND was any better at that than a number of good industrial teams. But what RAND was felt to be better at was sort of thinking through the problems of what was needed and why it was needed, and then, you know, beginning the quantitative process of specifying in detail what that implied. So we sort of invented requirements at here, and in the case of Wolstetter's Bay study, in the case of my ICBM study, that's essentially the position we're in. You know, we said here are the objectives that you want to accomplish, the political and military and strategic objectives, and here's how you can go about that, and out of that comes these sets of requirements. But, you know, we didn't start off with the requirements.
Well, but even the requirements that you develop in that context need to both reflect the needs of the Air Force as well as the capabilities of industry to develop them.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that came out of this process was that in a lot of cases, it turned out that our conclusion was that the military services had boxed themselves into an untenable technological corner by the way in which they posed specific requirements. And one of our functions was to say, well, you can get the same objectives, the same political and military objectives, by these different sets of requirements that don't box you in technologically but give you the same end objectives. Now, in industry, you had very little opportunity to do that because you were sort of at the receiving end of the requirements. And at RAND, the difference was that we could, you know, we weren't faced by that problem.
So how did RAND get into the position of being the definer or being able to influence it, things at one step before the...
It was simply given enough latitude initially by an entirely fortuitous set of circumstances, which is, again, the involvement of Frank Kolbaum. You know, it could have very easily happened since Project RAND started in industrial... environment, namely at Douglas Aircraft, that it could have gotten boxed in by exactly the same sets of constraints that the industry normally operated at in those days. Instead, what happened was that the arrangement to set up Project RAND that Frank Kolbaum worked out with people like General Arnold specifically said, you know, that RAND was to be given a large amount of liberty, and its function was really to investigate how the most military good could be produced to accomplish specific aims. It was given an enormous amount of built-in latitude in the way in which the RAND project definition was formulated in the first place. I think those documents, you know, the first statements of what Project RAND is all about that the Air Force produced, I don't know whether you've ever read them, but they'd probably be useful reading for you, because they make it quite clear that compared to the industry on the average at the time, RAND was given an enormous amount of latitude. And you know, there is even an apocryphal story, which may or may not be true. Well, part of it is certainly true. General LeMay was the first RAND project officer before he went to SAC. And he is, at least apocryphally, supposed to have been approached by people in the Air Force who found out about Project RAND and asked, you know, what are these guys going to do for me, and how do I get at them? And his response is supposed to have been, well, they're supposed to do good for you, but they're going to do it on their own, so don't bother them for 5 years. You know, that was kind of an unheard of thing. I don't know to this day whether that story is true, but it certainly could have been true. That was the amount of latitude that RAND had built in its original formulation.
It certainly rings true with some documentation that I've
seen. Yeah, I suspect it may well be true.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned earlier on, for example, when you were at the Aerophysics Laboratory, going back to this ramjet technology, that Jack Carter had come to you and said, we don't really need a 500-mile ballistic missile. We need something that can go over greater distances. So in that case, there was certainly kind of an interaction between
that's why I said, you know, that although in a sense the industry was supposed to respond to requirements, it really didn't work that way in practical life. There was an interplay, and that was a typical example of it.
Knowing that RAND had this latitude in evaluating requirements, did industry, in the case of, say, the ICBM studies, come to you and say, you know, we need some help in changing these requirements, or these requirements aren't really realistic? Was there any interaction with industry when you were going through this examination of requirements for various weapons systems?
Well, there was an interaction, but the position of the industry at that time was that they could in fact meet those very stringent requirements. It would just take them an uncertain number of years to do so. And our view is that the exigencies of the situation were that we couldn't afford to wait an uncertain number of years, that we had to have something operational much sooner, even if it were a cruder by industry standards. And so we were in a position to say, you know, we don't really need those very tight requirements. And we could defend that case. I think industry's position, Convair was the chief player at that time, was that, you know, you just tell us what you want and we can deliver it. It may take us a long time to do so, but we'll deliver it in the end. And our position was that events were moving very rapidly, and that you know, if you didn't have some kind of a response underway or in being in 1960, it didn't matter whether in 1970 you could meet these very stringent requirements. Now, that was a position that we could take, but which industry, A, did not want to take, and B, couldn't act on in any case. Part of the early RAND history, that work in mathematics and optimization and computer theory and AI and so on. That's a body of effort which is intrinsically, I think, very interesting, and in a few instances is also terribly important in a practical way. And it's that sort of thing, which doesn't capture a lot of popular imagination and therefore isn't reflected at all adequately in any of the existing histories or attempted histories around.